This is In the News for March 7th, 2006. I'm Scott Berguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. First story today is from the New Standard at newstandardnews.net. Conservationist Rev Up Roadless Rule campaign is written by Brendan Coyne. Efforts to control road building in the nation's wilderness areas saw new growth last week with a petition drive and proposed legislation seeking to bar logging and road construction on public lands. Thursday, a loose coalition of conservationist groups petitioned the administration to reinstate the 2001 Roadless Area Conservation Rule enacted at the end of Bill Clinton's presidency. The administrative law tightly limited new road and logging projects on about 58.5 million acres of national forest. The roadless rule was short-lived. The Bush administration and several courts nixed it in the following months. The groups delivered over 250,000 signatures, hoping to force the Bush administration to reinstate the rule, and demanded a response under the Rarely Used Administrative Procedures Act. The 1946 law allows citizens to directly request that executive agency decisions be struck down, altered, or issued and requires the federal government to respond. The petition has been circulating since last spring. According to the Forest Service, reinstating the roadless rule would protect lands inhabited or used by over 220 species of wildlife on the endangered species list. The large tracts of land that the rule would shelter also serve as the natural habitat for a wide range of animal and plant life that does not enjoy specific protections. In compiling information, the Forest Service also noted that the rule could lead to the loss of hundreds of jobs in the timber industry. Under an alternative White House plan, states would have to specifically seek protections for their national forest lands. The administration has opened several public comment periods on that proposal and in January extended the current phase for another 18 months, according to the U.S. Forest Service. Environmental groups and others contend that the Bush plan paves the way to private ownership of national forest lands. Last year, Oregon, California, and New Mexico sued the administration to reinstate the 2001 rule. Last week, Washington State signed on to the suit. Also Thursday, Senators Maria Cantwell, Democrat of Washington, and Jeff Miggeman, Democrat of New Mexico, introduced a new version of the 2001 rule. The Roadless Area Conservation Act of 2006 would cement the Clinton administration rule as federal law. Again, that's taken from the New Standard News at newstandardnews.net. Up next, from the Burlington Free Press in Burlington, Vermont, at burlingtonfreepress.com, written by Terry Hallenbeck. Burlington to kick off runoff. Tuesday's ballot, that's today, for Burlington mayor will look like no other most voters have seen. Instead of the old method of marking one candidate per office, city voters will be looking at a grid on which they may rank the five candidates. The process is called instant runoff voting, and it's hailed as a way to open elections to more candidates and diminish the risk that third-party candidates act as spoilers. The city is one of just a few in the country, including San Francisco, to use the system. Plenty of people around the state and nation will be watching to see how it works this week in Burlington. Joel DeMarsh, city elections director, said she's had inquiries from as far away as Alaska by officials interested in Burlington's inaugural run at instant runoff voting. What it means for Burlington voters is that they might want to take a few minutes to read the instructions. Residents were sent postcards detailing the system. Each of the city's polling places will be staffed with helpers offering instructions and answering questions, LaMarsh said. Instructions are also available at www.burlingtonvotes.org. No need to worry about making a mistake, though. If a voter marks two candidates as his or her first choice, for example, the machine will reject the ballot and the voter can try again, LaMarsh said. Voters have three chances to get it right. Although the process allows voters to mark their first through fifth choices for mayor, they may choose to pick only a first choice and leave the rest of the choices blank. Terry Mauritius, a former state legislator and elections consultant, said voters don't need to plot out any special strategies, just simply vote in the order of preference. He said, quote, voting for your second choice cannot help and cannot hurt your first choice, end quote. The rest of the work will be up to the machines that tally the votes. If no candidate wins more than 50% of the first choice votes, the candidate with the least votes is eliminated, and that candidate's second choice votes will be counted. The process continues until someone reaches 50%. Instant runoff voting applies only to the mayoral race, not to the city council seats or other items on the ballot. The new balloting brings another change to the voting routine in Burlington, LaMarsh said. Results will not be announced in each ward, but instead will be tallied at City Hall on Tuesday night. Again, that's from the Burlington Free Press at burlingtonfreepress.com. And finally, from the New Standard again, the newstandardnews.net, written again by Brendan Coyne, mine safety hearings produce little. Both chambers of commerce held hearings on mine safety last week under differing atmospheres of partisanship, but without reaching any significant conclusions. The hearings come amid news that nearly as many mine workers have died on the job so far this year as did during all of 2005. Last Wednesday, the head of the House Subcommittee on Education and the Workforce, Charles W. Norwood, Republican of Georgia, ended hearings half an hour early before a second round of witness questioning, additionally snubbing a group of minors and family members who had come to speak. The subcommittee did listen to statements from two Mine Safety and Health Administration officials, as well as representatives from United Mine Workers of America Union and the National Mining Association, an industry group. Much of the testimony revolved around improving mine safety technology, with discussion about communications and tracking systems taking up the bulk of the time, despite attempts by the United Workers Association Union Occupational Safety Administrator Dennis O'Dell to turn the discussion toward enforcement issues. Much of the testimony revolved around improving mine safety technology, with discussion about communications and tracking systems taking up the bulk of the time, despite attempts by UMWA Occupational Safety Administrator Dennis O'Dell to turn the discussion toward enforcement issues. O'Dell, who is a member of the United Mine Workers Union, charged, quote, MSHA has been neither aggressive nor consistent in enforcing the regulations that do exist. He said that, quote-unquote, compliance assistance or working cooperatively with businesses has become a higher priority than enforcing laws. O'Dell also said that several of the agency's regulations are, quote, directed at increasing productivity instead of improving miners' health and safety, end quote. For example, O'Dell noted, MSHA approved a rule in 2004 permitting mines to use the passageways housing conveyor belts to bring air into mine shafts rather than requiring a separate passageway be opened. The practice is in direct opposition to requirements issued in the 1977 Mine Safety and Health Act. Operators have successfully petitioned the agency for exemptions to the so-called belt air rule since MSHA's inception, O'Dell noted. According to a statement later released by subcommittee member George Miller, Democrat of California, Norwood ended the hearing without giving Democratic members a chance to question each witness for 5 minutes, as required under House rules. Norwood did promise to hold additional hearings, but none had been scheduled as of press time. By contrast, Thursday's Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions hearing was largely bereft of political strife. The committee heard from twice as many people and forced answers from MSHA, but did not reach an agreement to act on the issue. There are currently two bills dealing with mine safety in the Senate and one in the House. All three bills were introduced last month and contain provisions to tighten violation enforcement and increase mine safety regulations and requirements. As reported earlier this year by the New Standard, MSHA issued just 59 high-dollar fines measuring $10,000 or more apiece against mine operators in 2004, the last year for which complete information is available. The current penalty structure is 25 years old, according to MSHA. That, again, is from the New Standard at newstandardnews.net. This has been In the News for March 7th, 2006. I'm Scott Berguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. We'll talk to you next time.